This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 31st of March, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, NATO takes control of the Libya war, but the cost will still be heavy for US taxpayers. In Ivory Coast, as thousands of civilians flee the violence, forces supporting the recognized president, Alassane Ouattara, close in on the capital, Abidjan. And we go to the Philippines to speak with the family of a young woman executed in China for drug trafficking.
These drug traffickers, this drug syndicate, preys over the fragility of people.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Japan continues to grapple with the crisis at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The International Atomic Energy Agency has detected levels of radiation dozens of miles from the facility that would have triggered evacuations under the criteria used in the aftermath of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. The United Nations agency has urged the government of Japan to expand its mandatory evacuation zone. Dr. Edwin Lyman is a senior scientist at the Global Security Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Right now there are at least some hot spots up to 40 kilometers away from the Fukushima site that, at least according to Soviet standards, would have mandated relocation of the population. However, the Japanese authorities are still refusing to execute any such order.
Mandatory evacuation orders are in effect only within 20 kilometers, or 12 miles, of the damaged plant. In contrast, 2 days after the earthquake, the United States government urged its citizens in Japan to evacuate the area within 50 miles of the facility. Cabinet ministers in Kuwait tendered their resignations today. The move comes on the heels of demonstrations demanding greater rights for non-citizen residents of Kuwait. The resignations also allow three ministers, who are members of the royal family, to dodge a scheduled session of questioning before Parliament as part of a corruption investigation. The monarchy of Bahrain continues its crackdown on dissidents calling for governmental reforms. A prominent Bahraini blogger, Mahmoud Al-Yusif, known for promoting equal rights for Sunnis and Shiites, remains missing after he was arrested on Tuesday. Two other internet activists are reportedly in detention. The country's main Shiite opposition party, Al-Wefaq, says more than 300 people have been arrested as part of a government effort to stifle unrest. The government of Kenya has reversed a 20-year policy of accepting refugees fleeing violence and upheaval in Somalia. Kenyan authorities recently closed down a makeshift refugee camp without providing an alternative for the distribution of humanitarian aid. Human Rights Watch is calling on Kenya to immediately halt deportations of Somali refugees and to allow asylum seekers to file claims. Mohammed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Fighting between Somalia's weak central government and the Al-Shabaab militia has forced Somali civilians to seek temporary shelter in Kenya over the past 6 years. According to Nila Gashal of Human Rights Watch, the civilians often return to Somalia when the violence subsides. The periodic waves of refugees live in camps and receive services from an infrastructure of international aid groups.
It's become normal that there are flows of refugees across the border who come and go. There are also people whose lives have been seriously disrupted by insecurity in Somalia. Even the ones who make it into Kenya now are living in horrific conditions.
Earlier this month, the Kenyan government ordered the closure of temporary refugee camps in the town of Mandera without giving the Red Cross an alternative place to provide services. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Kenyan government to not deport civilians to areas experiencing violence, to allow fleeing civilians to file asylum claims, and to permit aid agencies to provide services to refugees. Mohammed Yusuf, FSRN, Nairobi.
Russian police have reportedly detained around 150 protesters demonstrating in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Opposition figures have been holding protests on the final day of the months with 31 days as part of a movement to call on authorities to respect Article 31 of the Russian Constitution, which supposedly protects the right to free assembly for the purpose of peaceful protest. In practice, demonstrations in Russia often face restrictions like required permits. And finally, two New Orleans police officers were sentenced today for the murder of a local man in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Zoe Sullivan has more. Of the five current and former New Orleans police officers tried for the murder of Henry Glover, two were acquitted, while three were found guilty. Today, a New Orleans judge handed down sentences for two of them. Former officer David Warren received more than 25 years in prison for manslaughter and deprivation of rights under color of law. The latter charge means that Warren abused his position as a police officer while committing a crime. Greg McRae, who is currently on the force, was given more than 17 years for using fire to commit a felony and deprivation of rights under color of law. Glover was shot in the chest from a balcony on September 2, 2005. When bystanders drove him to a local school to get help, they were allegedly beaten by police officers there, who then took the car with Glover's body and burned it. The case was brought to light by a ProPublica investigation after officers kept it covered up for years. A Department of Justice investigation concluded earlier this month found the New Orleans Police Department to engage in illegal racial profiling and disproportionate use of force, among other problems. The department will be supervised by federal and local authorities as a result. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Libya, Gaddafi's forces are continuing to make gains against opposition rebels. There are reports of heavy attacks by Gaddafi's forces on Misurata and Brega. Today, NATO officially took control of airstrikes, and there are increasing reports of civilian casualties. A Vatican official told Reuters that about 40 civilians were killed in Tripoli by an airstrike. NATO says it's investigating. The agency also quotes rebels in Misurata who say shelling from Gaddafi's forces killed another 40 civilians there. Meanwhile, a member of Gaddafi's regime, Foreign Minister Moussa Koussa, defected to the West and arrived today in the UK where he's being questioned. In the US, debate continues over involvement in Libya. Unnamed government sources told several news agencies that CIA operatives are gathering intelligence from within Libya. Some lawmakers, like Democrat Denis Kucinich, question the constitutionality of the government's military action. In a speech to Congress today, Kucinich quoted George Washington.
The Constitution vests the power of declaring war in Congress. Therefore, no offensive expedition of importance can be undertaken until after they shall have deliberated upon the subject and authorized such measure. Unquote. Washington.
Kucinich wants to defund the U.S. effort in Libya. Other lawmakers are also concerned about the cost of intervention. Today, Defense Secretary Robert Gates told the House Armed Services Committee that the cost of the Libya mission as of last Monday was about $550 million. He predicted that would go down to about $40 million per month now that NATO has taken control. Gates told the committee that the government has no additional military moves in mind beyond enforcing the no-fly zone and keeping the pressure on Gaddafi.
What the opposition needs as much as anything right now is some training, command and control, and some organization. It's pretty much a pickup ball game at this point. And the truth is, in terms of providing that training, in terms of providing assistance to them, frankly, there are many countries that can do that. That's not a unique capability for the United States, and as far as I'm concerned, somebody else should do that.
Another official testifying, Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg, compared U.S. involvement in Libya to the efforts in the Balkans that led to the removal of Serbia's former president, Slobodan Milosevic, from power. In Ivory Coast, forces loyal to the internationally recognized winner of last year's elections, Alassane Ouattara, have reached the outskirts of the capital, Abidjan, where the incumbent president, Laurent Gbagbo, refuses to give up power. In a further sign of Gbagbo's diminishing support, his army chief has reportedly defected. The situation for many thousands of civilians is critical. Amnesty International says 10,000 people have fled to a Catholic mission in the western part of the country. For more, we go to Dr. Usman Merzik Kobo, Professor of History from Ohio State University. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much.
Now, the conflict in the Ivory Coast has forced thousands of civilians to flee the violence. What do you know about the humanitarian situation there and what the civilians are facing?
The humanitarian condition is catastrophic, to say the least. Some of the things that are happening, especially in the city of Abidjan, the city of Abidjan is very modern, cosmopolitan, but it also has a huge population of supporters of Alassane Ouattara, and they are located in one particular area, Abou Bogar, which it has become very, very unsafe. We have information about people being massacred in the middle of the night, people being taken out and shot in public. It has become a common scene from what we hear from folks in places like Adjamé, another neighborhood in Abidjan, and Abou Bogar. We have heard people waking up in the morning and finding dead bodies of friends and relatives.
There's also information coming out from Human Rights Watch about a massacre of 37 West African immigrants from a village near the border with Liberia who were allegedly killed by forces loyal to Laurent Gbagbo. Do you know anything about the scale of the attacks on civilians?
I do not know the scale, but the number 37 seems to be a little lower than what we've heard other people say. Some people have mentioned more than 50 people at one particular spot. But, you know, note that Gbagbo's influence tended to be very strong along the western coastal part of Côte d'Ivoire. And therefore, this did not come too much as a surprise because it's something that has been going on a very low scale. And it comes out of probably out of desperation.
In recent days, the forces supporting Ouattara have made rapid progress. What are the reasons for that?
There are essentially three reasons that I can think of from the top of my head. One of them had to be the very, very strong support of West African, you know, members of the ECOWAS region, especially Ghana, Burkina Faso, and indeed Nigeria. To some extent, Liberia, which is not, you know, very very stable, it's stable but not as strong as one would expect, really encouraging Ouattara not to give in, because for Laurent Gbagbo to succeed, that will jeopardize the West African region's attempt to promote democracy and to recognize elected officials. So there is a pressure coming from the ECOWAS sub-region. In fact, Nigeria, leaders of the ECOWAS have made the argument that if Ouattara does not, if Gbagbo, does not leave, they may have to invade Cote d'Ivoire and take him out by force. So that is there. The international arms embargo also seems to be working because weapons could not be sneaked in through Ghana or through Liberia or through Burkina Faso. And Burkina Faso, the leader of Burkina Faso, whose wife is actually an Ivorian, is very, very active in ensuring that no weapons move from that region into Gbagbo's hands. So that is the second factor. The third factor, I think, has to do with France and the United States indirectly putting pressure on Gbagbo and opening up, you know, not only channels of communication, but also encouraging Ouattara to pursue Lawrence's forces as aggressively as possible. But within Cote d'Ivoire itself, there seems to be a greater momentum towards Ouattara. And therefore, internally, there have been people who have enlisted, as far as I know, who have enlisted as forces on the side of Ouattara. So there are these internal factors as well as external factors, which were the three that I gave you earlier.
Mm. What more can you tell us about the situation in Abidjan? Does Gbagbo still have control of the city?
Gbagbo, as of today, yes. Gbagbo still has a significant control, as far as I know, as of the news this morning. And I have not spoken with anyone directly in Abidjan, but I've spoken with some friends in France, in Paris, who have argued that yes, he still, as of this morning, he has some control, but that control is decreasing significantly, as you are aware of. I mean, the capital city, Yamoussoukro, is now in the hands of Ouattara, and they're moving on Abidjan. And people are really gathering forces, really, to facilitate Ouattara's expansion into Abidjan. But at this moment, yes, Gbagbo still has some impact.
Could this be the beginning of the end for Gbagbo?
Yes, this is the beginning of the collapse of his regime.
Dr. Usman Merzik Kobo, Professor of History from The Ohio State University, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me.
In China, three Filipinos were executed yesterday by lethal injection. The two women and one man were convicted of drug smuggling. Around 70 other Filipinos are facing the same fate. Many of them are young women, targeted by international syndicates and lured into becoming drug mules. And as Madonna Virola reports from Manila, some say victims don't even realize they're transporting drugs.
Jason Ordinario is inconsolable about the death sentence imposed on his sister, Sally Ordinario Villanueva. He relates the ordeal of a drug mule, which he knows quite well. He went undercover for the government to get evidence against some members of an international drug syndicate.
November 1, 2009. Yun po, 12 pieces muna po ang nanulok ko that time. Kasi malis po yung isang ano.
In November 2009, the syndicate which victimized my sister made me swallow 12 capsules containing heroin. The following day, they fed me and I eliminated said capsules in the toilet.
Tapos, pinalunok ulit sa akin.
Ordinario said he was made to believe by government officials that if he cooperates in the campaign against drug syndicates, his sister's sentence would be mitigated. But Sally's execution, along with two others, Ramon Credo and Elizabeth Batain, was not stopped. Family members and their supporters had been fighting for their release since the three were jailed in 2008 for drug smuggling. The Ordinario family believes Sally was innocent. Jeremiah Bellica is their volunteer lawyer.
The Ordinario family is a low-income family. Sally wanted to go abroad, and she was offered a job by her recruiter as somebody who would carry cell phones from China to sell here in the Philippines. So Sally, trusting her employer, her recruiter, acceded to that offer, not knowing that the luggage that was given to her, the employer said that for her, asked her to bring the luggage and to give it to their employer in China. So she did, and unfortunately, the luggage actually secretly contained 4 kilos of heroin.
Some say the Philippine government has not done enough to protect young people from the drug syndicates and to secure their release when detained in other countries. Gary Martinez is chairperson of Migrante International, a non-government organization assisting overseas foreign workers.
Talagang dismayado kami sa naging response ng gobyerno dito sa...
We blame the government. No Filipino would want to go abroad to become a drug pusher. The Department of Foreign Affairs has an internal policy where they only provide legal assistance when the sentence is already death. The government should have a policy of protective custody where our government should also investigate. It values its labor export policy and tries to be pleasing to its host country.
But the government claims it did everything it could. Sharon Agduma is a spokesperson with the Department of Foreign Affairs.
The Philippine government provided the three Filipinos all possible legal and consular assistance. The government ensured that their legal rights were respected and observed, and their welfare protected from the time of their arrests and throughout the judicial process, and even up to the last day. Their families have been informed of the carrying out of the sentences, and in fact, arrangements are being made were made for them to depart for China last weekend and in order for them to visit their families in China.
She added the humanitarian visit to Beijing of Vice President Jejomar Binay on February 18 stalled the sentences which were originally scheduled for late February. And she says, the government conveyed that it respects Chinese law and the final verdict of the Supreme People's Court on these cases. But activist Gary Martinez blames the criminal justice system in the Philippines.
Bakit lagi na lang ang biktima ang siyang mapaparusahan? Bakit ang...
Why is it that the victim always gets punished? How about the international syndicates? There are drug laboratories in the country, yet no one has been convicted. And sadly, this is due to defective warrants rather than the merit of the case, which is really large in scale.
May nakumbik ba? Wala nakumbik eh.
Migrante International and other groups have staged prayer vigils and rallies to raise awareness about these cases. The Department of Foreign Affairs too has an appeal. Again, Sharon Agduma.
We continue to appeal to all Filipinos, especially to our overseas Filipino workers, not to allow themselves to be victimized by international drug syndicates and to be extremely cautious when dealing with strangers in airports and other areas of transit. We wish to stress that vigilance is the first major step in combating the modus operandi of international drug traffickers.
Some advocates, including lawyer Belica, are concerned about the rising number of women who are ending up detained and charged with drug trafficking.
These drug traffickers, this drug syndicate, praise over the fragility of people. Praise over the weakness in mind, in body, economic needs of people. And women here in the Philippines, aside from they are very trusting, they are very diligent, they're very dependent, is a logical choice for drug syndicates.
Despite the executions carried out Wednesday, Belica says he's not losing hope about the other cases. He's urging fellow lawyers, the government, and even the private sector to volunteer their time to help stay the sentences or even free some of the 70 others currently sentenced to death in China for drug smuggling. Madonna Virola, FSRN, reporting in Quezon City and Manila.
Immigrant rights advocates in the U.S. have long pushed for reform to U.S. immigrant policies. Despite the deadlock in Congress, some lawmakers are still pushing for changes. On Saturday, U.S. House lawmakers will kick off a tour of 20 cities, highlighting the need for policies that keep families together. Matt Laszlo has the story.
Maria Bolognos called the police to report that she got into a fight with her husband in Prince George's County, Maryland. Instead of getting assistance from the police, she was turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Speaking through an interpreter, Bolognos asked for administration officials to change their immigration policy.
I'm here to ask President Obama to stop deportations and to put ends to programs like Secure Communities that separate our families. I am here because I want these injustices against the immigrant community to stop, especially for my daughter, who is a U.S. citizen.
For years, U.S. immigration policy has resulted in thousands of split families. And Roberto Aguirre from Chicago is concerned his will be next. He's a U.S. citizen, and so is his daughter. But his wife and son aren't, and ICE is trying to deport them. Aguirre came to the Capitol to ask the administration to be compassionate when dealing with immigration cases that could rip families apart.
I got my family over here, my son, my daughter, my wife. And I want to tell to Mr. Obama, stop the riots and keep our families together. Because we need our family, we love our family, we need all the families going to be together.
A group of House lawmakers, mainly from the Hispanic, Asian Pacific, and Black caucuses, are pressuring the administration to use discretion when dealing with deportation cases. Illinois Congressperson Luis Gutierrez says they aren't seeking amnesty or any changes to current laws.
We have not come here to ask the president to sign an executive order somehow relieving these families from being deported. We have not come here to ask for temporary protective status. We understand he has the responsibility and obligation to enforce the law. But he has, what we're asking him is to use the discretion that he has to implement the law and to have balance so that American citizen families can stay together.
The head of the Asian Pacific Caucus, California Congressperson Mike Honda, says these deportation policies are widespread.
Asian American and Pacific Islanders have a major stake in the immigration debate also, with over 1.5 million undocumented immigrants in the United States.
The group is also asking for the president to not deport DREAM Act students. Those are young people who would be legal residents under the stalled bill that provides a path to citizenship if they attended college in the U.S. or served in the military. Gutierrez says they're also sending
petitions to the president asking him to act now, at least to stop the deportation of millions of U.S. citizens, young people who should have been legalized via the DREAM Act, and stop the expansion of weakening public safety and serve as a dragnet for law-abiding immigrants should be ended.
In a White House video, President Obama said he supports the DREAM Act, but he refused to say if he would stop deportation of DREAM Act students because the ball is in Congress's court.
This is one more problem that we can solve if we're not trying to score political points off each other, but we're just looking at, how do we create an environment where this is a country of laws and a country of immigrants. And we can reconcile those two values, but we're going to have to do it together.
That isn't good enough for many immigrant families and the lawmakers who are pushing for a halt to the policy of deporting immigrants. Minnesota Congressperson Keith Ellison says the nation needs to stop dividing families of immigrants now.
Do the right thing. Don't take away the kids. Don't take away the parents. Keep the families together. People should be together.
They will now take their campaign on the road with a 20-city tour called the Campaign for American Children and Families, which starts in Providence, Rhode Island this Saturday. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
A familiar scene took place in Ohio last night. Following passage of a controversial anti-union bill, crowds jeered and yelled, "Shame on you," to lawmakers after they voted to send SB 5 to Governor John Kasich for signature. Kasich, while acknowledging there was opposition to the legislation, called it a victory for taxpayers.
When your average private sector employee is paying 23% of their health care costs and your average city worker is paying 9%, I think it's fair to create a balance, number one. Secondly, my greatest interest in this bill was giving local governments, local governmental entities, including schools, the ability to manage their costs.
But opponents say the bill is an attack on the working class. Charletta Tavares is a Democratic senator representing Columbus.
This bill is, in my opinion, a smokescreen for another agenda. Payback for those who disagree, did not support, or who do not come from wealth. This is about what is fair, what is not fair, what is not just, what is not equitable, and what is not right. We want a middle class, we say. We want local control, we say. We're eliminating both.
The bill passed earlier this month by a one-vote margin in the Senate. It passed yesterday in the House 53-44, with five Republicans joining the Democratic opposition. The bill limits collective bargaining rights for more than 300,000 public sector employees, including police and firefighters. It also prohibits strikes, takes away automatic pay increases, and requires employees to pay more for health insurance. Some call the measure more restrictive than Wisconsin's bill, which is now hung up in the courts. Tune in to FSRN Friday when we examine what opponents of the bill are planning in response to its passage. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Visit our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.